So last week we contemplated stories from Zen women of the past who had to contend with challenges to their right and their ability to take their place in the world as Zen practitioners, as teachers. If you remember, Mugai and Nyonen were willing to literally deface themselves, scarring their faces to erase their beauty, to make themselves repulsive to the monks who were threatened by their presence, or to demonstrate their non-attachment to their appearance, to their own beauty. And then there was Miao Zong, who responded with physical daring and verbal wit. She was, in case these Chinese names are hard to remember, she was the one who summoned the head monk to an audience with her and appeared naked before him and then dismissed him, as you recall. And then there was Ziyong, who responded with a combination of fierce wisdom and generous compassion to the, he was a scholar, not a monk, he was a scholar who approached her and said, I've come to visit the great ship of compassion, but who would have thought she was just an old crone? So those were some of the stories. And some of the questions you may have considered this past week include what sacrifices or trade-offs have you made to follow a path of your choosing? What strength can you depend on when you step close and encounter what is deeply true about yourself and the world? And when you are being expected to efface yourself or silence yourself, where do you draw your strength to take your place in this world and to offer your being just as you are? When the scholar asked or challenged Ziyong, saying, I've come to visit this ship of compassion, but who would have guessed that ship of compassion would turn out to be nothing but an old crone? Where did she get her strength? Ship of compassion, by the way, I found out doing some more reading this week, was actually a title, an honor bestowed upon her by the emperor for her work establishing a convent in the capital of Beijing. Ship of compassion, that's quite an honor, an honorific name, isn't it? So here's another story about her. She's one of my favorites. So this time it's a monk who's challenging her. And the monk says, 30 blows, are they the actions of a man or an enlightened being? Well, we may have wondered that too when we read those stories sometimes of Zen masters whacking their students and them, you know, kind of slapping each other around. And you think, is this enlightened behavior? Or what? Certainly those kinds of behaviors can easily be contaminated by our character traits, by ego. But Ziyong, I don't think, really fell into his trap. She said, just as long as the fellow isn't beaten to death. So I think she's maybe being a little bit facetious. And I think he's maybe challenging her about that sort of stereotypical Zen master behavior of, you know, whacking him the student a whack when he's not satisfied with the student's response to a Dharma question. And she seems to refuse to play that game to give him a definitive response. She dodges rather deftly, so long as the fellow isn't beaten to death. So the monk tries again. This time he asks, when you speak, the congregation assembles like clouds. In the end, who is the great hero among women? So feels like maybe he's pushing her to, you know, take a sort of inflated role, you know, the great Zen master among women. But here's what she says. Each and every person has the sky over their head. Each and every one has the earth under their feet. She refuses to play his game of comparisons. The archetype of the Zen master is great hero. Each of us is an awakening being standing upright between heaven and earth. That's the human condition. Each of us is living Buddha nature. So he tries one more time. This time he gives a huge shout, another Zen stereotype, right? Big yell. And she replies, "What is the point of recklessly shouting like that?" Again, she refuses to be taken in, to play a sort of stereotyped Zen game. Finally, the monk bows respectfully. And Ziyong says, "The Dharma does not rise up alone. It can't emerge without reliance on the world. If I take up the challenge of speaking, I must surely borrow the light and the dark, the form and the emptiness of the mountains and hills and the great earth, the call of the magpies and the cries of the crows. The water flows and the flowers blossom, brilliantly preaching without ceasing. In this way, there is no restraint." I really love that passage because it so beautifully expresses how we can draw strength from the very earth, the mountains, rivers, the birds, and trees and wildflowers, when we take up the challenge of speaking from the heart of our lives and our practice. In this way, there is no restraint. I really feel that I don't think I could ever have begun the practice of giving Dharma talks and continued the practice of giving Dharma talks without that reliance on the deep sources of the very earth itself. So, with that little introduction, let's get into small groups again, like we have been doing, and see what emerged for you as you practiced with the stories, the images, and the questions from last week. And you know, I'm not expecting you to cover all the different stories. Really, whatever feels really strongly resonant for you, whether it's an image or a story or a question, and then how you have practiced with that during the week, and maybe how you've expressed that in some form that you might want to share or just even talk about doing. Okay? And from what I've been hearing from the people I've spoken to in Doksan, sounds like the groups are settling, you know, the small group, you're getting the hang of how to do small groups on Zoom. So I don't think I need to send you timing messages. Just everybody be mindful of each taking a turn. And I'll just give you a 1 minute left warning. Okay? So I'd like to move into our stories and theme for this coming week. There was a question that came up last week, and it was at the end of one of the commentaries. It was the end of the commentary about Ziyong and the scholar. And the question was, is it necessary to leave home in search of the truth in order to learn that you don't have to leave home to search for the truth? You know, there's that leaving home and then returning, that cycle that we have. And coming to our true home, there's that verse. It's from the Thich Nhat Hanh's Vietnamese Zen tradition, and we chant it here at the beginning of our zazen time with an incense offering, and it goes: we offer this incense to all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas throughout space and time. May it be fragrant as earth herself, reflecting our true nature and fruit of understanding. May we, maybe,
A whole heart of wisdom.
And the fruit of understanding. Here's the important part. It's all, may we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. That's the line. May we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. So that's linked into this question of home leaving and home returning or staying home. This is intriguing to me because I was definitely a home leaver. I left at the age of 17. Maybe some of you left early as well, on a kind of quest to learn how to live in a world where there's so much human cruelty and injustice. And you probably know that Buddhist monks and nuns have traditionally been called home leavers. Home leavers in the sense of letting go of attachment to all it takes to maintain a home and a family, and leaving and having no possessions, except the robe and the bowl. Following the Buddha's example, when, as a young man, he left the safety of his the palace where he was raised, left his family and his young son, his wife and son, after he encountered the reality of human suffering, sickness, old age, and death. And he was determined to find a way to be free from suffering, to live with a mind open and supple, free from the push and pull of desires, the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. Those are all the worldly winds that blow us back and blow us around all the time, because we want this and we don't want that. And to find a true home in that freedom. But I've heard, and I've asked myself, I've heard women ask, and I've asked myself, well, what about his wife? What about his mother? What about their spiritual yearnings? Well, the legend goes that the Buddha returned to his family after his years of ascetic practice and after his enlightenment experience. And after he had begun to travel and teach, he returned to his family. His son, Rahula, was the first to ordain and join the Sangha. And I think many of you know the story of his aunt and stepmother, Pajapati. We often say her name Maha Pajapati. Maha means great, so great Pajapati. Her name was Pajapati. And his mother having died soon after his birth, he was raised by her sister, who in all likelihood married, became a wife of the king. Pajapati led a group of women, including the Buddha's wife, Yasodhara, to petition the Buddha to allow women to ordain and join the Sangha. This is a famous story that many of you know, but it bears repeating, I think. So here's how it's told in the Hidden Lamp collection. Mahapajapati was the aunt and stepmother of the Buddha and a queen of the Shakyas. Many women turned to her for counsel when their husbands and sons left home to join the Buddha's order. She was the first to ask the Buddha if women could also ordain. The Buddha replied, "Don't set your heart on this." She asked two more times and received the same answer, and then departed in tears. Later, she gathered 500 women who cut off their hair, put on saffron-colored robes, and walked barefoot for hundreds of miles to where the Buddha was teaching. Weeping, they stood outside the gates. We actually did a reenactment of this at the Zendo last year, some of you may recall. Ananda, the Buddha's faithful attendant of many years, saw them there and asked, "Why are you crying?" "Because the Buddha does not permit women to ordain." So Ananda went to the Buddha and said, "Your aunt is standing outside with swollen feet, covered with dust, crying because you do not permit women to ordain." It would be good, Lord, if women had permission to ordain. The Buddha replied, enough, Ananda. Don't set your heart on this. Ananda asked two more times to no avail. Then he asked, are women able, Lord, to realize the full fruits of the way, even arhantship? So an arhant is an awakened person who is free of hindrances. And the Buddha replies, yes, Ananda, they are. Women are fully able. Ananda replies, since women are able to realize perfection, and since Mahaprajapati was so kind to you, caring for you and suckling you at her own breast, surely it would be good if women were allowed to ordain. The Buddha relented, and the Sangha of women was born. There's more to the story. The Buddha added a certain number of extra rules for women to follow. But the question for us here is, what is it to set one's heart on freedom and to have that aspiration repeatedly denied or betrayed? To yearn for an education, or life as an artist or writer or scholar, a career in science or law or medicine, and to be refused entry, or if admitted, to be belittled and harassed, or to learn that the price of admittance is giving access to one's body. This is an experience many, many women have known over the centuries, one that has been compounded by racial, ethnic, and religious injustice, and class as well, class. I knew nothing about the Buddha's quest when I set out on my own, and I also had no awareness of how much of my own personal pain and the social and political conditions of my upbringing in the United States was contingent on gender inequality. Racial inequality was visible to me. You know, I grew up in the civil rights era in the States, and the Vietnam War, which was a profoundly racist war. But gender inequality, while not exactly invisible to me, was unacknowledged, completely unacknowledged, in my years of early schooling. So this quest, and the gendered nature of this quest, given our society, has been something I've pondered and puzzled over for many years. In our Japanese Zen tradition, priest ordination is called Shuke Tokudo, leaving home, attaining the way. And the ceremony we call Jukai, receiving the precepts, is also called lay ordination, or Zaike Tokudo, staying home, attaining the way, or being home, staying the way. So leaving home, attaining the way, staying home, attaining the way. Two paths of practice, both completely valid. But in our tradition and lineage, there's not such a big difference between the two paths as there is in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, early Buddhism. And here in the West, I would say there's even less difference between the lay path and the path of ordination, of priest or monk ordination. Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center, our Dharma great-grandfather, once quipped, we're all kind of in between lay and ordained. We receive exactly the same set of 16 bodhisattva precepts. Lay people can practice side by side with ordained priests at most Zen practice centers in North America, And many fully ordained priests are also married and have, and some have children, some have jobs, and especially when they practice and teach in a context of a lay practice community like ours. So for all of us, I think leaving home and staying home are more cyclic, more metaphorical, more interpenetrating even, permeable. We extend our practice from the Zendo into every aspect of our daily lives, bringing mindful awareness to our speech and action in the world, and cultivating a kind of openness of heart and flexibility of mind that allows us to live in this world on the Bodhisattva path with full engagement. Some of us lead more home-based lives. Some of us raise children. Some pursue a career or a professional path. And most in our time combine these various commitments, combine family and livelihood commitments. Some of us stay close to our place of birth. Some travel the world. Some form long-term monogamous bonds. Others choose other forms of intimate relationships. Some, as I said, have children. Some do not. So what place does a commitment to spiritual practice have in this array of choices and responsibilities? From the very beginning, there were awakened women lay practitioners in the Buddhist tradition. Though many of their stories are lost, I believe that there have been wise women and healers in all cultures throughout human history who lived the life of a bodhisattva. Many have been persecuted, even killed. Many lived quietly and inconspicuously, but people came to them for help. And many remained anonymous, their stories never written down. So I want to share a few of those stories that have come down to us and been collected in the Hidden Lamp collection. Some of us know early on that we don't want to follow a conventional path. Some girls fight back and rebel. In 18th century Japan, there was a devout layman who had a rebellious young daughter named Satsujo. He took her with him whenever he visited Master Hakuin Eikaku, who was a renowned Zen master, in hopes his influence would rub off on this young girl. Satsujo became quite devoted to practicing the Dharma, but she was a handful even for Hakuin, who was known to be quite a fierce Zen master. When she was 16, her parents were concerned that she might not find a husband and asked her to pray to Kannon, the Bodhisattva of compassion. She did this day and night during all her activities, and before long, she had some kind of awakening experience. One day, her father peeked into her room and saw her sitting on a copy of the Lotus Sutra. "What are you doing, sitting on this precious scripture?" he shouted. And she replied, "How is this wonderful sutra different from my ass?" She was not going to settle for second-rate piety. Some of you may be able to relate to Satsujo with her stubborn insistence on authenticity. If so, what has tempered your adolescent righteousness with patience and compassion? Satsujo continued to refuse to marry and wanted to become a nun. But Hakuin persuaded her that her path was to continue practice as a laywoman. He said to her, "You comprehend Zen well, but you need to put it into practice. Spirit and form, enlightenment and actualization must be harmonized with the realities of everyday life." So he called her on this sort of intense zeal and said, "No, you have to live this. You have to live this in the world." So she did marry, and had children. But she continued to practice with Hakuin, and she became very well respected as a lay teacher herself. One day, she met with Hakuin, and he explained a koan to her, and then asked, "How do you understand this?" She replied, "Would you please go over it again?" As soon as he opened his mouth to speak, she put her hands on the floor, bowed deeply, and walked out the door. Hakuin exclaimed, "Oh dear, I've been trounced by this terrible little woman." They had a very, very warm and playful relationship, as the stories go. As I said, she went on to have many children and grandchildren, and we'll hear more about her next week. Many of the stories of awakened laywomen that have survived in the Chinese and Japanese Zen literature just refer to an old woman. And they are some of my favorites. Often the old woman is selling tea and snacks by the roadside. Watch out. Here's a story from 9th century China. Deshan Xuanjian was a great scholar of the Diamond Sutra, but he was not a Chan practitioner. Chan is Chinese for Zen. He was not a Chan practitioner. He was traveling south in search of the Dharma, carrying his commentaries on the Diamond Sutra with him in a big sort of basket-like pack. In the course of his travels, he came across an old woman on the roadside selling tea and rice cakes. He asked her, "Who are you?" She responded, "I am an old woman selling rice cakes." When he asked if he could buy some refreshments from her, she inquired, "Venerable priest, what are you carrying in your bag?" I think it was a basket. He said, "I am a scholar of the Diamond Sutra, and I have all my notes and commentaries." Hearing this, the old woman said, "I have heard that according to the Diamond Sutra, past mind is ungraspable, present mind is ungraspable, and future mind is ungraspable. So where is the mind that you wish to refresh with rice cakes, O scholar? If you can answer this, you may buy a rice cake from me. If not, you'll have to go elsewhere." Deshan was dumbfounded, unable to reply. The old woman then directed him to a Chan master nearby. He burned all his notes and commentaries the next day and took up Zen practice and actually became a renowned Zen master himself. One more. Magu, Nanchuan, and another monk were on pilgrimage. Along the way, they met a woman who had a tea shop. The woman prepared a pot of tea and brought three cups. She said to them, "O monks, let those of you with miraculous powers drink tea." The three looked at each other, again, dumbfounded. And the woman said, "Watch this decrepit old woman show her own miraculous powers." She picked up the cups, poured the tea, and went out. The three looked at each other. I love the way these old women use the mundane activity of serving tea and snacks to teach the Dharma. They had, I think these old tea ladies had a kind of freedom and mobility that women of the higher classes did not in those times. Women of the wealthy, educated classes in medieval China were often confined to convents when they ordained as nuns, in accord with the Confucian injunction that a proper woman should not step over the threshold of the inner chamber, let alone, and this is a quote, climb high places or stand on the edge of deep chasms. But in the 17th century, there was a resurgence of interest in Zen, which gave nuns a new degree of mobility. Times were changing. So Ziyong, who we've met already, was born as an only child to parents who were in late middle age already. Her father had retired from the emperor's service and lived the life of a gentleman farmer, kind of a genteel, educated farmer devoted to Buddhist study. Ziyong was drawn precociously to spiritual practice and wrote in an account that may be an authentic autobiography, or it may have been a kind of fictionalized account written by someone else. But it says, as a child, I never engaged in silly talk or laughter, and as soon as I grew a little older, I became determined to leave the world. In other words, to become a home leaver and enter a convent. Her parents were reluctant at first, but they did give her their consent. So she didn't have to go to the extremes that others did, the extreme of defacing herself, or of waiting, or of marrying and waiting, you know, decades until she was widowed to ordain and enter a convent. But she traveled extensively. She was often on pilgrimage. She went and practiced with different, with various Zen masters, both before and after becoming an abbess and founding a prestigious convent in Beijing. So I want to close with two short poems she wrote about her travels. First one's called, and this is a wonderful book. It's a scholarly book, but it's got a lot of great stories in it. It's called Eminent Nuns. Isn't that a lovely photo on the cover? By Beata Grant, great, wonderful scholar. First one's called Traveling in the Mountains. Staff in hand, I go through the woods, stirring up the fallen red leaves. Suddenly, I hear a clear chime carried by the autumn wind. I'm afraid that next time I won't be able to find this place again. I'll try to remember that solitary pine hanging from the cliffside. Second one, a traveler's gatha. Gatha is a short verse. I still think about carrying my travel bundle in those days gone by, traveling the hills, frolicking in the waters, coming out in cloud country, eyes open and eyebrows raised in astonishment. Everything is samadhi. And in this great earth, there is nowhere that is not a wisdom hall. So those are some examples of the lay path, the path of the home staying, the home leaving paths from women, our women ancestors. So I'd like us to kind of consider that question of your own quest or journey of awakening. Were you a rebellious, irreverent adolescent, or precociously serious and focused one? Has it been a path of home leaving or home staying, or some combination, a winding path? What obstacles have you encountered? How have you steered your course? What is your true home? I'll send these questions out to you. But right for now, just think about your path in terms of those two aspects, the home leaving and the home staying, and see what comes up for you. Maybe just take a few minutes to jot some things down, and then we'll get into small groups, okay? And you may find that see what comes up in terms of, you know, that there are Dharma gates that open in home leaving and Dharma gates that open in home staying. What's your experience been? What's your path been?